It's Susan Page of USA Today. Great to be with you. Diane is on vacation. She'll be back next week. On my mind, just over a year ago, Diane interviewed Financial Times columnist Edward Luce for a book he had just published called The Retreat of Western Liberalism. He talked about the forces that brought not only President Trump to office, but also led to Brexit and the rise of other populist leaders in Europe. With trade wars heating up, longtime U.S. alliances being tested, and Trump's upcoming meeting with Vladimir Putin, it seemed like a good time to invite Edward Luce back on the podcast. Thanks for joining us, Ed.
Many thanks for having me.
A remarkable NATO summit this week. After watching it, here's what you wrote in the Financial Times. Liberal America famously took Mr. Trump literally, but not seriously. Europe should not repeat that mistake. What does that mean?
So I think Europe is still in the moral outrage phase about Mr. Trump. There's kind of a suspension of disbelief that he cannot be serious. The idea that he would, for example, agree to permit Putin's annexation of Crimea or withdraw American forces from Germany is just preposterous. It's not really going to happen. He's just provoking us and we are morally right and he's just an idiot. And that's, I think, a misreading of him. He is quite serious. And he is quite capable of pursuing Vladimir Putin's agenda and also of essentially pulling the plug on the transatlantic alliance.
Do you think that he, in fact, threatened to pull the United States out of NATO at this meeting?
Yes. I mean, he pretty much did so publicly in his form of words. Apparently, he's far more emollient in the private meetings. And so a lot of it is, you know, discounted as grandstanding by some of the more hopeful European leaders. But the consistency with which he pursues this rhetoric and follows up with actions in all kinds of other areas, you think of trade, you think of climate change and so forth, I think suggests he is serious about the NATO alliance.
In the past 70 years since NATO was founded, has there been another president who challenged the European leaders the way Trump has done? Has there ever been a time like this before?
Well, I suppose you could say in the LBJ Nixon era, you know, there was no European support for the Vietnam War. It was deeply unpopular. Even Britain stood aside from the Vietnam War. So there were moments there, Reagan, when he was president, and with the cruise missiles going into Europe, there were massive protests. But Reagan, you know, stood shoulder to shoulder with Helmut Kohl and Margaret Thatcher. They stood shoulder to shoulder with him. Even Mitterrand did. So I think this is new. I don't think we've ever had a U.S. president who's attempting to undermine the very liberal democracy on which the transatlantic alliance is based. And one other point here, these demonstrations that are taking place in Britain, quite sort of popular ones and quite imaginative, creative ones, are very, very deliberately saying in public, this is not anti-American. We are asking for Trump to stand up for American values. And so it's quite different to the kinds of anti-American protests you'd have seen on mostly on the left in the 80s or the late 60s.
Well, I actually covered some of the NATO summits when President Reagan was going to them, and there would be often massive demonstrations in Germany and elsewhere against his nuclear policy, among other things. But there was never a sense that NATO's existence was being questioned. This does feel more existential when it comes to the alliance that has held the peace for these decades.
I think it couldn't not feel like that. You know, he's going to meet Putin. He keeps praising Putin as an upstanding man, as a kind of leader he likes and admires. He keeps dissing Merkel, May, and other European leaders. He keeps talking up the Putin-esque challenges to the established order in Europe, like Matteo Salvini, Viktor Orban, and so forth. How could you interpret him otherwise? If we're going to take him seriously now as well as literally, how could you interpret this other than as a joining forces with Putin's attempt to undermine that liberal democracy?
When you're able to say something like, if the United States withdraws from NATO and that's not impossible, shouldn't our jaws drop? Isn't that an extraordinary possibility?
I think it's a terrifying possibility and a realistic one. I think, you know, when you talk about the liberal world order, it's an abstraction. The real building block of it is the transatlantic relationship. And without that, you do get a sort of massive global vacuum, and you get a kind of dog-eat-dog, maybe Trumpian world of Russia and China and America, pretty hopeless Europe that is not unified. So these three big powers competing in a sort of zero-sum way, you get a power vacuum. And geopolitics abhors a vacuum. It's much, much more dangerous than even a China-led world is to have a chaotic world.
It was almost precisely a year ago that you came on Diane Rehm's podcast to talk about your new book. It's called The Retreat of Western Liberalism. So just briefly remind us what your premise was in that book a year ago.
Well, I wrote it sort of shortly after the sort of momentous year of 2016, what first began with Brexit and then followed up with Trump's victory in November, as an explanation as to why the populist problem that we were all sort of suddenly getting up to speed on didn't begin in 2016. It's actually the culmination of many, many years of breakdown of public trust in the West for politics as normal, and that these trends go back quite a long way. I mean, if you think of the Bush administration, from 2002 to 2007 was the first business cycle on record where the median income was lower, household income in America, at the end of it than at the beginning of it. And that this had sort of this trend of people not feeling that equality of opportunity was real anymore, that meritocracy was fake, that had been creating a toxicity in our politics for a lot longer. And Trump sort of is more of a symptom of that than a cause. So I don't have any sort of side in terms of this, I think, rather false argument as to, oh, is it caused by economics or is it caused by cultural reaction? Clearly the two sort of chemically interact and make each other worse. But I do feel that, you know, this shouldn't have taken us completely by surprise, 2016. This has been brewing for a while.
We're always smarter later on, right?
We are. Hindsight's a wonderful thing.
I listened to the interview that you did with Diane a year ago, and in it you said that your editor, your publisher, wanted you to call it the collapse of Western liberalism, and you insisted on just calling it the retreat. And I wonder, would you make the same argument today? Are we closer to a collapse?
I think we've beat a hastier and deeper retreat than even my pretty pessimistic forecast would have held a year ago. I don't think we're yet ready for collapse, and I pray we're not yet ready for collapse. I think that, you know, the old Churchillian saw that democracy is the worst system apart from all the others remains true. I think that China under Xi Jinping, which is a major development in the last year, that he has aggrandized so much personality, cult and power to himself. China, Xi Jinping might have bitten off more than he can chew. And so that's one to watch. And that democracy cannot be counted out. But we are doing our best, it seems, perhaps unintentionally, to discredit our form of politics and our way of life. And things are, I fear, going to get worse before they get better.
You know, I think Americans sometimes comfort themselves with the idea that there is an arc of history that bends in the right direction, that bends toward democracy, and that there'll be setbacks, of course, but over the long haul, you can count on democracy to prevail. Do you think that's true?
I hope it's true. There's been a very popular, deservedly popular book recently called Enlightenment Now by Steven Pinker. And he makes the point, look, what are we all complaining about? We live longer. Our children are less likely to die in childbirth. We're less likely to be killed in homicide than ever before in human history. And medicine is, you know, beyond what it's ever been before. And that's going to continue to be the case. And he's absolutely right on the data. But it did strike me that you could have made that argument in 1938 about 1848. Look how much better we are than during the Victorian era. What are we complaining about? I think what he misreads is the crooked timber of humanity argument, is the sort of status anxieties, the jealousies, the inequalities, the zero-sum nature of politics. And we're at that kind of moment. I'm not saying we're on the eve of a Second World War, but we're at the kind of moment where trust in our system, the belief in the sort of modern god of our society, which is meritocracy, has just vanished. And when you get belief vanishing, you get either atheism, which I think you see, you know, in the form of nihilism in politics, or just a sort of anti-politics politics that is perfected by Trump, diabolically perfected by Trump, or you get agnosticism, is people just drifting off, stopping participating. And I think, you know, the measure of that, the measure of a health of a democracy, I've always felt this, is trust in public institutions. You know, trust is the glue of any democracy, and when trust goes, it's very, very hard to reconstruct it. You need sort of quite a dramatic series of events to bring people together again.
Well, if there's one thing that's marked President Trump's administration, it's the demise of trust, the erosion of trust in the news media, in the courts, in the FBI. That's one of the characteristics I think that we've seen in the last year and a half.
Yeah, and he sort of, you know, he rides on that lack of trust and fuels it. And so there is a sort of end of days quality to Trump that, you know, it doesn't matter what happens after me. You know, I can destroy the tools at my disposal. Perhaps, you know, because there's the Robert Mueller investigation and, you know, that's one of these institutions and it threatens him. But Trump is making he's a cure worse than the disease. But trust is cratering elsewhere, too, even in Germany, which has had a sort of fairly respectable level of politics. It's been less prone to cynicism. And they're more serious. They don't, you know, they don't mix the entertainment industry and politics. They have a church-state division, if you like, between celebrity and public life. Even there, you're seeing these really sort of sharp declines in faith in the system.
And, of course, Trump is visiting Britain this week. We see Theresa May in some peril, her government in some peril. And could President Trump's visit affect her situation one way or the other?
That's an interesting question. I mean, as you know his itinerary very clearly avoids population centers because he's not a popular figure. And as I say, I wish to underline, he's not unpopular because he's American. He's unpopular because he's behaving in what is perceived to be an un-American way. And I think that's a really important point to emphasize. But it's a working visit, not a state visit. He will not address Parliament. He will not be received by the Queen in Buckingham Palace. So it's all sort of like in rural byways. I think May probably is cut some slack in that you have, in the same way maybe Macron is, you have to flatter. You have to sort of accommodate. You can't sort of go for cheap applause lines by insulting the American president, even if it's Donald Trump. And so I suspect her problems are really not that much to do with Trump. They're self-created, and they're very hard to get out of.
So we've had these two very contentious summits, the G7 summit in Canada and then the NATO summit in Brussels. And after both of these summits that were quite contentious with our traditional allies, the president has gone to meet with authoritarian leaders, with Kim in North Korea in the Singapore summit, now with Putin in Helsinki. Is that, do you think that sends some, what message does that send, do you think?
I think that, you know, all these leaders in the West that we've just been talking about, you have perfected the art of flattering Trump, and they've discovered that flattery gets you nowhere. But it might get you somewhere in real time. He's very, very rarely rude face to face, particularly when the microphones aren't on. He's actually quite, by all accounts, he's quite cordial in private. But then when he's on the plane, when he's maybe not even on the plane, in the motorcade, he's back to tweeting the same kinds of insults that were there before the meeting. People like Trump and people like Putin and Kim Jong-un and even Xi Jinping to some extent haven't tried flattery, but they've got a lot more respect from Trump. So I think it's less to do with whether you flatter or don't flatter and more to do whether he envies you or doesn't envy you. And I do think he envies strongmen. I think he envies authoritarians. And there's a sort of, there's a very odd sort of coin there of love and hate between people he has contempt for, liberal democratic leaders, and people he has admiration for. And flattery's no, doesn't get you out of it.
So that's a miscalculation on the part of some leaders.
Well, it could be worse than not flattering him, of course. They've got, you know, if they took to insulting him, you know, there are real consequences. The things that Trump could do, you know, he could target Britain. He could pull the plug from the whole fantasy agenda of the May government. The May government's agenda is, after Europe, we will then have this great bilateral deal with America. And Trump could point out, no, you won't.
You know, one argument that some have made is that the president's rhetoric at NATO was pretty divisive. But the president's actions at NATO were to endorse an agreement that reaffirmed the buildup that was agreed to in 2014. And he didn't take an action that undermined NATO. And that we should pay attention to what he does and not to what he says. What do you
think
about
that? I think that's quite right. I think that's absolutely right. I do think a large part of the evaluation will only come after he's met Putin. And we've got some sense of what they agreed at the official bilateral summit, but also at the one-to-one private meeting that they're going to have before. And Putin's got a very clear anti-NATO agenda for Ukraine, for Crimea, in terms of the American and NATO presence on Russia's border in the Baltics. And if Trump makes any concessions in that direction, those are the actions on which Europe will America's NATO partners will judge him.
And what options would Europe have if he does make concessions?
Europe doesn't have too many options. You know, the America needs Europe less than Europe needs America. And the every American president has been asking Europe to step up and spend more on its defense, and it's a perfectly reasonable demand, particularly of countries like Germany, which is like 1.2% of GDP. It's not that much more than half of its commitment. And it's a massive surplus country in terms of its current account. So it can afford to. And in fact, in its own interest, it should be spending more on defense. So, you know, Trump is not wrong about that. And if an unintended consequence of Trump is that Europe does get so panicked that America is off the scene, plus Canada and maybe Japan and Australia, that it starts behaving as the West minus America, hopefully temporarily, then this might not be what Trump intends, but it could actually be a good thing.
A good thing for Western liberalism.
Yes, if we're going to see a glass as half full, that would be it. That it panics, it galvanizes. I mean, look at the response to the Trump's withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. You know, May, Merkel, Macron, the three M's, as I like to call them. There's May, not a crack of daylight. Post-Brexit Britain is standing there saying, no, we've got to uphold the international order. That is sort of so deeply ingrained that even Brexit and, you know, soccer matches do not come in between that.
A year ago, when you talked to Diane, you talked about North Korea being the biggest threat on the horizon. And I wonder if that is no longer quite the case, if the situation with North Korea is still very uncertain, but does it look a little less perilous?
Very much depends on how Trump interprets the fact that Kim Jong-un has no intention of sticking to what he misdescribed as the contract he signed with Trump in Singapore, which, of course, was no such thing. Kim Jong-un has no intention of disarming. He's not provided even the basic sort of logistics or inventories of his nuclear assets. And he rebuffed Mike Pompeo on his recent trip to Pyongyang. He's got China far more on his side than he did a year ago. So how does Trump react to the fact that this deal is a failure before it is stillborn? Does he just pretend, which he's quite capable of doing, that it was a success and it remains a success? Or does he at some point react very badly? In which case, you know, you do have the John Boltons of this world ready there with their original plan A's, which is a far more militarily aggressive response to North Korea.
So a possible military response that might get us into a war with North Korea.
So what would happen if Trump said, you know, I agreed to suspend U.S.-South Korea joint military exercises. Well, now I'm going to have them and they're going to be much more sort of large scale and we're going to have nuclear assets. How does Kim respond to that? And how does Trump respond to Kim? It this could turn on a dime. It's a very what's the word for it? I'm trying to search for the right term. Volatile situation, a diplomacy that is quite foreseeably heading into a brick wall.
One of the things that's perplexed a lot of us since Donald Trump had his political rise in 2016 is why he has this positive attitude toward Vladimir Putin. Do you have a theory on what's behind his approach to Russia and to Putin?
I know European diplomats who know Russia very well. Some have been based there for years. And some various people in more shadowy who argue quite earnestly that he is essentially a paid agent of the Russian state. Now, I've yet to see sort of proof of that, but their arguments go further than, look, his actions are consistent with that theory. Their arguments go into the degree to which the Steele dossier has proven so far to be largely accurate. Of course, it wasn't a finished, it was raw intelligence. And their arguments go into the money trail and the degree to which the Trump organization's reliance on Russian business and money flows had produced a sort of financial dependency of Trump on Russia. His cravenness towards Putin, you know, has dated back many, many years and actually predates Putin. He was attempting to get into the Moscow real estate market in the 80s. So I don't know whether that's going to be true or not, or whether Robert Mueller, you know, is coming up with that kind of report. But I do think there is more to this than simply Trump has, strongman envy. I think it is deeper than that. Quite how much deeper, I wouldn't dare predict.
Quite extraordinary idea, though, to entertain.
It is an extraordinary idea. I mean, it's one of those. If you look at those sort of movies about the. What's the movie
called?
The Manchurian Candidate. This is far more exorbitant than Frank Sinatra playing the Manchurian Candidate. This is an extraordinary, and that's why it's hard for people to digest. It's so preposterous, it could not be true.
Let me ask you one last thing, and that is one of the challenges, I think, for reporters covering President Trump has been to focus on what really matters and not on the latest shiny object or the latest provocative tweet. So what, in terms of President Trump's leadership in the world and in terms of the future of Western liberalism, what is important, do you think, to be watching?
I think the most important thing is the U.S.-China relationship. I think that was already true 10 years ago. I was recently in Singapore. Which is this small city state, which became a very, very prosperous, went from sort of dirt poor in the 60s when it got independence to being a very prosperous country by the 80s, 90s, because of America, because of Pax Americana, because of the openness of trade regimes, because of the openness of its education system, which has sort of trained Singapore's elite. And yet they're mostly ethnically Chinese. So their understanding of and skin in the game in terms of both China and the U.S. and their geography, they live in an unstable neighborhood, makes them, I think, the most acute and perceptive observers of the future of U.S.-China relations. And what I took away, I spoke to most of its senior leaders there, what I took away was that their heart is with the West. They are really rooting for the West to succeed. They need two wings for the plane to fly, and the West is one of the wings. But their head is with China now. They believe that China is playing a long game, that China has educated itself about the world, that, you know, whatever mistakes it makes in terms of shoving boondoggle projects down, developing infrastructure projects down sub-Saharan throats or whatever it might be, that it's actually just as smart as it is stupid. But most of all, this is a long game China is playing. And what they kept referring to despairingly was how the United States and the West in general cannot see beyond its own nose any longer. Its politics is just eating itself up, and that strategic sort of policy planning is impossible with this kind of politics. And that to me was really, really more depressing than any sort of Trump tweet about Kim Jong-un. It was a cultural reading of politics, deeper than day-to-day, from people who want the West to succeed and hope that they're wrong. And so the U.S.-China relationship, that's the most important one to the future of the world.
Edward Luce, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Susan. It's a pleasure.
Now, a quick break. And when we come back, why the three words Moscow is silent are key to understanding Vladimir Putin's rule in Russia. And we're back. On Monday, President Trump will meet in Helsinki with Russia's Vladimir Putin. In 2015, NPR's Melissa Block guest-hosted the Diane Rehm Show. She talked to New York Times reporter Stephen Lee Myers about his book, The New Tsar, The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin. Here's an excerpt from that conversation.
Stephen Lee Myers, I was really fascinated to read in your book about the conditions under which Vladimir Putin grew up in Leningrad, a tiny, tiny apartment, no hot water.
That's right. He grew up in a communal apartment, which was very common, of course, in the Soviet times. But after the war, his parents had been assigned to one. As a family, they had one room. They shared a kitchen. The toilet was down a hallway. People who were there who visited him, one of his school teachers, described it as just horrid conditions. Mm. It's not clear that he really understood the deprivation that he experienced at the time, but it was clearly a very humble beginning.
And it didn't seem like anybody back then would have pegged him as the man who would go on to be the all-powerful ruler of Russia.
On the contrary, I don't think anybody, even when he grew up and became an officer of the KGB, that he had the ambition, or anyone would have seen in him that kind of ambition to become a mm-hmm. political leader in the country.
It does seem very much a fluke that he ended up joining the KGB, as you write about it. It was a film, a 5-hour film, The Shield and the Sword, came out in 1968, I believe, that he saw and convinced him that he wanted to be a spy.
So there was an effort to kind of, you know, buff the image of the KGB a little bit. And one of the results of that was this film, which is really quite a terrific film, black and white, very moody. Putin to this day can sing the theme song.
Does he really?
He can, yes. He's done it on occasion, even played it on the piano
once
at a charity auction. And it had an indelible impression on him as a young man. And, you know, when it came out, he was a teenager. And as teenage boys often are, they can be quite moved by mm-hmm. something that's as romantic as this. The basic story is of a KGB officer who goes deep undercover as a German speaker, and it essentially begins as a driver and then infiltrates the ranks of the Nazi military command mm-hmm. and as a result is, you know, decisive in the war effort. And he saw this, and as he tells the story, and as one of his friends did, the next day he decided he was joining the KGB and even went audaciously to the KGB headquarters to volunteer, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's not how it worked with the KGB, apparently, so they turned him away. But the officer who was there was very patient and said that if you want to do that, you should go to university, you should study law, which is exactly what he did. He was very committed to the idea once he embraced it.
He does become a KGB functionary, not terribly high level, as you describe it. And I want to fast forward to 1989. He's based in East Germany for the KGB. What happens when the Berlin Wall falls? How did he respond to that, and what did he take from it?
He watched as an officer in an outpost in Dresden. It wasn't the main headquarters for the KGB, which was in Berlin, of course, but he watched the events unfolding. He said later that he could see it coming. And his job as an intelligence analyst in the Dresden KGB office would have been to see it coming and write reports back home on it. Unfortunately, we don't have a record of those. partly because they said they burned a lot of them. Hmm. But, you know, his job there was to conduct counterintelligence, to recruit agents, supposedly. We don't know a lot about what he did, but he was certainly there when the events in 1989 began and the protests began, and it led eventually to the Berlin Wall coming down. The Soviet leadership at the time under Gorbachev had decided essentially that they were no longer going to be able to support the Warsaw Pact countries. And then, as you know, during that incredible fall, they all spun off. Mm-hmm. And he was there the night in November 1989 when, after the wall had already come down, when German protesters in Dresden had essentially stormed the Stasi headquarters, the headquarters of the East German secret police, who were even more dreaded than the KGB mm-hmm. were. And the KGB villa was just across the street. And once they had essentially stormed, broken into the Stasi headquarters, a group of them, not all of them, came over because it was clear that this other villa where Putin had served for 5 years at that point mm-hmm. was, you know, part of the apparatus. And Putin describes, again, going back to the sort of humiliation that greeted the collapse of the Soviet Union, he wanted orders. He couldn't find his boss at the time. He wasn't the senior officer in this small outpost. He called to the military base because, of course, the Soviet army had enormous bases in East Germany. They said they couldn't respond because, and it's a phrase that seared in his mind, Moscow is silent.
Moscow is silent.
And he didn't know what to do. His instinct was that he had to protect this, not just the villa and the handful of officers that were with him. And, you know, he was worried about the files inside.
Well, he'd seen the Stasi headquarters get ransacked.
I mean, from where he was, from the balcony where he was, from his building, he could see what was going on. And you know, protesters, jubilant protesters, were pouring through the files at this Stasi headquarters, which was almost like a compound in itself. And he was very much concerned that they would come through and they would get the files that had the names of agents and so forth. And so he, in a very bold act, walked outside and confronted this crowd that had gathered in front of the villa. And some people have described this in almost mythical, cinematic terms. But in fact, he went out alone, unarmed, and in perfect German that surprised at least one of the people out there that I talked to, told them to go away, that he had orders, which he didn't, to open fire if anyone tried to enter the compound, that it was a diplomatic facility under the protection of the Soviet Union.
He was bluffing.
He was bluffing. And it worked. And a couple hours later, finally, the army sent a couple of armored vehicles and soldiers over. But by that point, you know, they had secured the building. But for Putin, it was doubly humiliating and doubly disturbing. One is that the mob had taken over, in his view. Mm-hmm. You know, the masses and the hysterical masses in his mind. But also that, like, his government, the government that he had served so loyally, you know, in the same kind of romantic way that inspired him to join as a teenager, had completely failed him. Mm-hmm. And the experience in the next few weeks when he was essentially packing up to leave and then retreating back, leaving behind Stasi friends, and in his mind, they just abandoned, the Soviet Union, abandoned their allies in Eastern Europe. And that was something that gnawed at him. One of his oldest friends told me that he almost blamed himself for that. Hmm. And he thought it was a humiliation for the Soviet Union to have done that the way they did.
Well, as you think about how Vladimir Putin has ruled in Russia, how do you see those echoes of that humiliation, as you call it, that abandonment that he felt, shaping how he's governed?
I think from the beginning, his goal has been to restore the power of the state, the central authority of the state. When he was plucked from relative obscurity by Boris Yeltsin to become first prime minister and then acting president on New Year's Eve, 1999, from the moment he took office, in a period of great chaos, he felt like his mission was to somehow put the country back together again. Not the Soviet Union, as many people feared and still fear, but to right the state, and to stop the chaos. And it's a motif that he talks about. It comes up over and over again in the propaganda, in his speeches, in the biographies that are written about him in Russian, that he is the guy whose mission it was to return Russia to its rightful place on the world stage. Especially in the beginning, he understood the weaknesses that Russia faced, and he benefited greatly from the rising oil prices after the 1990s, after the financial crisis in 98 when Russia defaulted on many of its loans. And he was able to use that rising prosperity to essentially reassert political control that had been weakened under Yeltsin, especially at the end when he was sick, also reassert control over the economy, state corporations, giant energy companies that are owned by the state. Mm-hmm. And in his mind, this was ending this disintegration that had continued after the collapse of the Soviet Union, threatened to continue. The war in Chechnya was another example of he responded so forcefully because he saw that as yet another chunk of the country falling off. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that at some point some other agent somewhere would call Moscow and Moscow would be silent, he was not going to let happen.
And you can hear that entire interview at dianereem.org. That's all for this week. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Ben Privett. Thanks for listening. I'm Susan Page.